Good afternoon. I'd like to call House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, March 1st, and the time is 1:32 p.m. We are meeting in the Max Grunberg Committee Room 120 in the Capitol Building here in Juneau. I ask that you please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Talia with the Juneau LIO and Sophia with House Records. Following members present is Representative Johnson, Representative Gray, Representative Carpenter, Representative Groh, Vice Chair Allard, and myself, Chair Vance. We have a quorum to conduct business. We have two items on today's calendar, and that is to consider the appointee for the public defender and also bring back House Bill 238, Criminal Mischief in the Third Degree by Representative Josephson. First on our agenda item, we will consider the governor's appointee to the public defender office for the state of Alaska, Mr. Terrence Haas. He is joining us here in the room today. If you could please come to the table, place your name on the record, and introduce yourself to the committee and explain why you want to be the public defender. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Vance, Vice Chair Allard, members of the committee. Thank you. Good afternoon. I appreciate the time to tell you a little bit about myself and give you an opportunity to ask me any questions you might have. My Alaska story is in some ways pretty typical and maybe in other ways extraordinary. It's typical because I finished up a clerkship with the Rhode Island Supreme Court about 15 years ago and thought maybe I would come to Alaska for a couple of years. And 15 years later, I find myself here before you all. And I think that's kind of a typical story. Come for a visit and stay for the rest of your life is kind of an Alaska thing. On the other hand, the place I came to was Bethel, Alaska, to be a public defender there. And that's where I've spent all 15 years up until now. And I think that's probably unusual. I spent the first 5 years there in the trenches working cases at the public defender until I made it up to felonies. And then I supervised that office for an additional 5 years. And then I was appointed to the bench in Bethel and was on the Superior Court there as a judge for 5 years. And for the last three of those, the presiding judge for the 4th District, which includes Bethel and Fairbanks and the administrative responsibility for that district. And so I have quite a bit of legal experience and a little bit less administrative experience, admittedly, although the presiding judge is a pretty significant responsibility. And then I chose to take this job, and I often get asked and don't have trouble answering the question, why would you go from the bench to take over the public defender agency? And the answer to that question is because I have a significant passion for and believe in public defense as an extraordinarily important part of our justice system. When the public defender operates effectively and when its lawyers are well-trained and zealous advocates, our system works much, much better than in any other circumstance. And even from the bench and even now, I can see that we're in extraordinary times post-pandemic and with the labor market with attorneys here in Alaska. And so I could see the need for some leadership, and I wanted to try to do what I could to step up and help address those issues. And so that's what brings me here today. Luckily, I happen to be in town for some other purposes, and so I could appear here in person so that you all could gaze upon me. I know it's not a beauty contest, but it's a chance to see me nonetheless. So I appreciate it, and I'm happy to take any questions you all may have.
Thank you, Mr. Haas. I'd like to state for the record, we've been joined by Rep. Seminar at 1:33. Vice Chair Allard.
Can you state again the reason you left the being a judge or left the bench, however you want to state it?
Yeah. So, I had been a public defender for 10 years before I took the bench and had a significant passion for how that agency operates and functions. I was, of course, neutral as the judge and was on the, in the middle of everything during the pandemic. My time as the presiding judge was largely during the pandemic. And so I was able to see up close and personal what the pandemic did to all the agencies, to our justice system in general. We turned off trials for a time. We had difficulty moving the system forward, and that had a significant impact on everybody involved, including defendants and including the agencies involved. And so I just felt strongly that there was a real need to work hard to get the public defender agency in particular back up to snuff, sort of. And I think the attorneys there are wonderful attorneys. They're excellent. We've always had very passionate, hardworking attorneys. We have some of the best defense attorneys in the state and in the country working at our public defender. But during that time, we had a real outflux of attorneys. We lost a lot of lawyers. Caseloads rose, and it became difficult, I think, for a lot of the lawyers who stayed and worked the line you know, despite those difficult conditions. And the result is now we need to work a lot on recruitment and on training and on retention and on getting folks feeling like they're supported in the trenches. And I felt like I, with my previous experience, was in a position to bring some of that to bear.
Follow up?
Do you have any social media?
Like personal social media? Not that I'm aware. So in order to have a social media account for the Public Defender Agency itself, I've had to create one. I might have an old Facebook page floating out there, but I don't have significant social media, no.
So you don't have any social media that you're – apologize for the chair. So you don't have any private social media, anything like that?
Not that I think I might have a Facebook account, but I wouldn't even know the password anymore. It's been a very, very long time since I've engaged in social media. I'm probably unusual that way. In fact, when I took over the agency, I felt like it was necessary to have some social media presence to recruit. But that's pretty much the limit of my involvement in any social media at this point.
My husband doesn't either. You're not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Crow.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. First, I want to say I very much, as a former prosecutor who's done a little bit of criminal defense, I very much appreciate the role of public defense in our system that allows it to work. And if you're going to have a functioning criminal justice system, you have to have functioning criminal defense, including given the nature of the number of defendants and their resources, well-functioning public defense system. I'm a little unclear in terms of sort of the immediate role. Are you on the job now as public defender?
Yes, I am.
Could you describe the process of how that occurred?
Like how I got to the office, kind of? Or,
yes.
My predecessor had resigned, leaving a gap. And so at the point where I was appointed by the governor, I took over as interim, essentially. And so at this point, I'm only acting essentially public defender until you all and a bunch of others sign off on my role as chief public defender.
Follow up.
Yeah.
Did you apply while a judge? What was the process? I mean, I just want to say I so much share another committee's viewpoint. In Alaska, I've seen judgeships be very coveted and people work very hard to get them. Let's just say it's not entirely, unknown for this to occur. It's an unusual path, and I'd like to describe, if you could describe a little more of how this occurred.
Representative Groh, through the chair, my apologies. I'll try to stick to the formalities. I completely recognize that it's an unusual choice. I think it's probably unprecedented in Alaska. I'm not aware of anybody who has stepped down from the bench to take over, certainly the Public Defender Agency and perhaps any agency. For a lot of reasons that have to do with our perception that judges are kind of at the top of the pile for what you would do as a lawyer. And I don't disagree with that. It's an extremely important job, and it comes with a lot of status. On the other hand, sometimes important things present themselves, and sometimes we make choices to do things we think are right or important or even difficult for the principle of the thing, just as much as for the status or the pay. And so, that's as clear an answer as I can give, because I saw a thing that I thought ought to be done. And so I felt compelled, called to step up and do it.
Thank you.
Any other questions from committee members for Mr. Haas? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. I think I'll take a stab at this, just trying to get a understanding and flavor of your thinking. On your resume here, it has publications. And I assume those are publications that you are published.
That's correct. What you, yes, that's right.
Wrote.
Representative Carpenter, through the chair.
I'm specifically looking at Advocating for Parents in Rural America, a Best Practices Approach. And I'm wondering if there's any nexus between your thinking there, and I haven't read this. So is this going to describe how you would approach advocating for those who find themselves in the judicial system, and you're now advocating for them as a defender?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I appreciate the question. Yes, so that article was during a period of my career, I handled almost exclusively child in need of aid cases. And during that time, I was going to several conferences and meeting with folks about how do you do that job in a place like Alaska. we're a tiny, enormous state, you know, and it's, and in that sense, as you all well know, the difficulties in providing services across such a vast area with such a such a spread out population, those challenges are enormous. And having been in Bethel for 15 years and having had the challenge of sitting on the bench during five of those, I got a very intimate understanding of how difficult that is and how difficult it is because much of the power structure and money and provision of things is centralized where all the population is. And that's just an extraordinarily difficult circumstance. And so, yes, I felt that I could do a lot in the role of public defender, taking my experience from having been all of my time in Alaska, pretty much living in the bush. I thought I could bring that experience to the public defender in a way that might help us improve the way that we serve those people, you know, our fellow citizens who live in distant places like Bethel. That's 56 villages all attached to a hub, not a road to be found to connect to one of them. And that's pretty extraordinary across the country. And it's extraordinary for us in Alaska and how we grapple with that. And so I do think that experience was valuable.
Thank you.
Representative Gray. Nope. Are you sure? Okay. Any further questions from committee members? Thank you, Mr. Haas, for coming before us today. I am going to open up public testimony on this appointment. Is there any member, anyone in the room who cares to give public testimony? Seeing none, I will now move to online, and I am not seeing anyone online, so I will now close public testimony. Thank you so much for taking the time to come in and be present, and I know that you have been going and meeting different members of the legislature and just making a personal connection, and that means a lot to us. Thank you for your service in the state. And I will now read the associated memo for this governor's appointee. In accordance with AS 39.05.080, the House Judiciary Committee meeting held its hearing on the following appointee to the public defender of the state of Alaska, Terrence Haas. A signature on this report does not reflect any intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions. So I will now take a brief at ease so that members can sign the report. Thank you, Mr. Haas, for coming before us.
Thank you, Chair Vance, members of the committee.
Back on the record. For our second and final agenda item today, we will bring back House Bill 238, Criminal Mischief in the Third Degree, by Representative Josephson in its second hearing. The bill sponsor has requested an amendment for the committee to consider based on concerns referenced in the first hearing. And so we have that drafted before the committee today. Vice Chair Allard, may I have a motion?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number one.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you. There's been an objection. And I would, Rep. Josephson, come to the table and please describe the amendment and we can further this discussion.
Sure. Can I invite Mr.
Schroeder?
Please.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Andy Josephson, House District 13. For the record, the amendment, I haven't done this before, and I didn't even know if our attorneys would allow me to, because I don't sit on your committee. You may have noticed that. But what we did is simply hear questions that were raised last week, if that's when it was, and then I had a conversation with our rules chair as well, and we asked Ms. Radford to draft an amendment. That's been done. One thing that could be very helpful, and we have 10 copies if your staff would want to distribute it, but we have what I'm calling a version that is more readable so that you don't have to fight your way through the deletions and insertions. And it may ease the discussion. But essentially what the...
Representative Josephson, yeah. Would you please put your name for the record for the recorder, for
sure.
The secretary?
Did I not do that? Andy Josephson, House District 13.
Thank you.
What we tried to do is make sure that the thing that is covered and protected by criminal mischief in the third would include the grounds and all other religious institutions used for worship, but also used to educate the public about a religion, like a museum that is not, frankly, I don't know whether the property underneath the museum in Anchorage is museum property. I bet it isn't. But we then had a discussion about exhibits that could be on display at, for example, the Anchorage Museum or the Pratt Museum or fill in the blank, and wanted to cover those. And we think we've done that. So we think we've broadened this, but not in a way that is excessive and that captures, for example, one of the photographs of a swastika chemically emblazoned into the grounds of the former Anchorage Baptist Temple. That would be a covered event under this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Did Mr. Schroeder have any comments, any further details about this amendment?
For the record, Alexander Schroeder, staff to Representative Josephson. Chair Vance, I have prepared just a breakdown of the amendment that I can go over that would describe how it achieves the concepts that the committee presented last time, but it's up to whatever you'd like.
Well, let's take a brief at ease. Back on record, thank you, Mr. Schroeder, for the distribution of the material. Would you please walk us through this?
For the record, Alexander Schroeder, staff to Andy Josephson. Through the chair, I would be glad to walk you through it. Thank you for the time. So the first change that was made is the word personal was deleted. And with discussions with legal, they said that by deleting that, we know the result is that it would include objects. And so things like an exhibit are now covered because that could be considered, the elements of that exhibit could be considered an object or other related objects. But the way that property is defined in the statute, legal's confident that this would now cover all forms of property, not just the specific forms under personal property.
Representative Sumner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the chair, would you consider a Facebook page property?
Through the chair, Representative Sumner, Andy Josephson for the record. I'm looking at the definition of property that applies across the board in all Title 11 circumstances. It's subsection 53 of 1181-900. It includes intangible personal property, including data or information stored in a computer program, system or network. So I'm looking at this sort of the first time, but it sounds like maybe. But don't ask me clever questions about Facebook, please.
Follow
with
up.
With respect.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, my question follows off of Representative Sumner's a little bit more tangibly. We have some religious institutions that are like in a strip mall. And my question is about defining what part of the strip mall would be the religious institution and which part wouldn't be. I mean, it might be a technicality, but I feel like if you have like a sushi restaurant and a church and then a fried chicken restaurant, and then, you know, I guess there'd be some prosecutorial discretion as to whether or not the defacement is part of the religious institution or not. I guess like what I want to hear is like what defines the religious institution when the property is shared is a probably better way to say it.
Through the chair, the language would require that the property belonged to the religious institution. So if in the I'm thinking of the Sears Mall in Anchorage with a big hallway. If in the hallway management had allowed a religious display in front of a church within the mall, and that was defaced or desecrated, that would be covered. But the next door restaurant absolutely would not be covered.
Follow up.
So just correct me if I'm wrong. If it sounded like that the church needed to own the property. So if the church were leasing the property, would it still be their property?
For the record, Alexander Schroeder, through the chair, Representative Gray, I think technically yes, depending on what the definition of belonging means, but my intuition says that it would be if they're leasing the property.
Representative Josephson, this begs a further question of property that belongs to a religious institution that may not be used for religious purposes. For instance, an empty lot, or if they owned, for instance, if a religious institution owned the strip mall that was not used for religious purposes but was leased out to other people, would this amendment inadvertently cause this to fall under the same offense?
To the chair, Andy Josephson, for the record. So I think that it would have to be a property used for worship or any other religious purpose, or used to educate. I mean, the property at a church on the grounds, sometimes called the curtilage, for example, would be, I think, covered because it belongs to the religious institution. But if something doesn't clearly belong to a religious institution, couldn't clearly be determined to be for educational public purposes about religion or used for worship or some other religious purpose, I think the prosecutorial discretion would have to strongly err to not filing a complaint.
Further questions from members?
I have a question.
Representative Carpenter.
And I'm not exactly sure. Does it matter whether the person knows that it's a religious institution? What if they were doing this and they didn't realize it? Are they still covered?
Through the chair, Andy Josephson, for the record, the Representative Carpenter, the crime is a knowing crime. And the definition of that is broader than one might think. So it really relates to whether you knew the thing you did, you were doing. It's not, you don't have to have that level of intent. It's just an awareness that the actus reus, they say, the act, was that you were performing the act. And so there can be a degree of negligence that might, I think, speak to a lower sentence, for example. But I can read the definition of knowing, because that's the definition or the culpable mental state that applies. And it says, with respect to conduct or to a circumstance described by provision of law defining defense, that's what we have here. When the person is aware that the conduct is of that nature or that the circumstance exists. And I think what that means is it's much less than intentional. It's simply conducting yourself in a volitional way, if that makes sense. So some accidental desecration of a religious item or institution could fall under the rubric of this bill.
Representative Sumner.
Through the chair, I think perhaps the question was more along the lines of if you could not know or reasonably be expected to know that the property belonged to a religious institution, do you think there would be the mens rea to apply this?
through the chair, Representative Sumner, the definition does include in it, in 1181-900, that the knowledge is established if a person is aware of a substantial probability of its existence. So, and I suspect, I'd have to read the case law, but I suspect that there would be a sort of a reasonable person test applied to that kind of thing. And so, for example, in my former district at Providence, in the main sort of driveway there to the front of the building is a large 6-foot statue of Jesus Christ. It would be hard to desecrate that and not know that that was a religious symbol and that that would be captured in this bill.
Follow up?
Thank you. Through the chair. So I was thinking more along the lines of there are or have been churches in my area that own car lots. Would desecrating that car lot, if it belongs to a religious institution, potentially fall under this, or could you not reasonably be anticipated to know that it belonged to a religious institution and therefore this would not apply?
Through the chair, Representative Sumner, I suspect that this may reach the outer limits of my knowledge of the culpable mental state test and that Ms. Schroeder of the Department of Law may be better. But I think at that point, even though it belongs to a religious institution, the case is stronger that that couldn't have been done knowingly in the circumstance you've provided, because there would be an insubstantial probability of the existence of any knowledge that that was owned by a religious institution.
Representative Groh.
Aren't there some acts in which, even in a parking lot, that it would be lead more to a reasonable belief that there's the knowingly standard is met? I think of an example of someone spray painting a swastika on the parking lot of a synagogue. Mm-hmm. That would seem to show more, not just knowing that meet the knowingly standard, but more of an intentional standard. But if you could address, for example, that hypothetical. Representative Joseph, through the chair.
So through the chair, Representative Groh, that sounds both knowing and intentional, and intentional crimes meet the standard of knowing by definition because they sort of have this descending order. I hope that's helpful.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gray and then Rep. Carpenter.
Thank you. Through the chair, my question is kind of flipping the Representative Sumner, Representative Carpenter question on its head. Let's say, for example, you had a mosque and across the street there was a parking lot that was not owned by the mosque, but there was a large offensive anti-Islamic sign from that parking lot being displayed toward the mosque. It technically wouldn't be on the property on the religious organization, but the intention is to be seen by the religious organization. So my reading is that it wouldn't qualify, but yet I feel like it most certainly should.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I don't think that would be a covered item. And I think we're getting into First Amendment areas. A member of the mosque be offended and fearful? Yeah, I would absolutely be afraid and fearful. There is, if you really want to know more about this, there's a good decision called RAV versus City of St. Paul, where the Supreme Court, and I don't remember the details, but on facts similar to that, they found no liability. So I understand the issue you're raising, but the question is, do we want to prescribe that as illegal? And that's not what my bill's trying to do.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So going to the amendment, subsection I or subsection 1, belonging to a religious institution, semicolon, used to educate the public about a religion, semicolon, or. So do I understand that the one section, subsection, belonging to a religious institution is a and to be combined with used to educate the public about a religion, or is it also an or?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, they're both or. So number I is an order, or number 2I is an or.
Follow up.
Okay, so if we have a building that's used to educate the public about religion, then it would stand alone. It would not have to be owned or belong to a religious institution, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, that is correct. And so an indictment, which would have to be brought under Criminal Mischief 3, could charge simply C-double-I. And if the grand jurors said, well, what about C, 1I and 3I, to the extent they'd even know, because the indictment wouldn't mention them, they're not relevant. The elements of the crime are C-2I, and that's what would be presented at trial with jury instructions.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
So I know that in my community, I think this is probably something that's happened in other communities, a local church would rent or be allowed to use a auditorium or a gymnasium in a public school or other building. And so it seems to me that if there was some defacing of the school that was addressing the church portion of that, whatever program was happening there, that instead of it just being a vandalism charge, it would now be subject to this charge as well. Am I understanding that correctly, at least the intent?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I think a wise prosecutor on the facts you've given me would be smarter to charge the C3, because I think you could get into defenses with C2 that the Juno Public High School was defaced on near the swimming pool, and there was an event inside of a religious nature. And I don't think that's a very strong case, right? So I would, if the facts supported it, they may just not support it, depending on where the desecration occurred within a larger building. I don't know if that's helpful.
Follow up?
Yeah, just as I read it, I think that if you had a worship service at a school and there was desecration of the school that could be tied to the religious activity, then it would reason that it would be covered under this. And it is already illegal to deface the school, but it would be doubly so now.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, it is illegal now, and it would be somewhere in the criminal mischief in the fourth right now. This is gonna have some fact specificity to it. It's gonna, as with all crimes, it's gonna require the wise discretion of the prosecutor. Thank you.
Representative Sumner, then Representative Gray.
So through the chair, since the definition of property can include, I suppose, digital media and things of the like, and desecration, I would assume, doesn't necessarily always imply physical damage. If somebody had a religious radio broadcast or podcast and were taking callers, and a caller called in and essentially desecrated the broadcast, could that be a covered event or no?
Through the chair, Representative Sumner. So the definition of property talks about an article. That would not, what you've described, be an article. Substance, not that. Thing of value, not that. And then it describes more narrowly those three categories. So I think we start, as I read this, give me 1 second. I don't view that. I understand that the definition includes networks and so maybe that means a radio network. I don't know enough about that sort of argument, but I don't think that that would be a covered event. And I think at that point you're really into First Amendment land and freedom of speech. That's my answer as I sit here.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I just did a quick Google search of. Well, there's two universities in my district. They both offer classes in religious studies, some of them very specific to the Bible. I'm curious if that would make my universities used to educate the public about a religion, if it would make the whole university potentially the law might apply.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, good question. I think this comes down again to the discretion of a prosecutor. We actually talked about this in my office. I don't know if it's because you're right across the hall and you broached the office about the subject. But I think that if there's no desecration in a hall of at the College of Liberal Arts, and there's none in the engineering department, and there's none in the athletic department, and none in the history department, but it just so happens in the theology school, there is something. I think that meets the elements. And I would say that APU and UAA are not used, broadly speaking, to educate the public about religion. They are used in very narrow circumstances to educate the public about religion. And that's the best answer I can provide.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my intention of bringing this forward was to broaden it, and I appreciate the effort. But in my mind, if you've got a gang that's going around tagging everything and there happens to be a church in the middle, I'm not sure that's desecration like painting a swastika on the church is. So I'm not sure that tagging is desecration as much as specifically targeting the religion. So if we've got, you know, we've got something, someone out there with a sign, for example, that may be offensive, but it's still First Amendment, or if it's just a gang tag or somebody doing artwork or chalk on the sidewalk that's hopscotch, that's not the intention of this. The intention of this, if someone goes out and maliciously desecrates, you know, or what that, but that's the word we're using, desecrates a religious activity or property, that rises to the level of needing this, where someone doing a gang tag going to every building in a mall, that's, religion is not the issue, and it's not religious persecution. It's just, well, stupidity, but we can't legislate against that, or we'd be a better society. So I think there needs to be a distinction, and I think this does that, between just, you know, one extreme, a hopscotch on the sidewalk versus the swastika on the side of a church or burn into the grass. So that's kind of the purpose. So I don't want to go down the trail of, you know, if you just happen to spill paint on a sidewalk, you're desecrating, as opposed to the intent. And I think a swastika on a church is intent, clearly. Gang tagging is just stupid. So I think that and I don't know if we can discern that, but I think this does what we want to do. So I don't want to go down the rabbit trail of just spilling a paint can is desecration. There has to be a certain intent, and the intent is in the message. So I want to be clear that the purpose is not just to, we're painting a building, but it's the intent, and it truly is desecration and being derogatory towards any religion or belief. So that was kind of the purpose for it. I think this does it, and I don't want to go down a rabbit trail of the church in the mall that, you know, every building gets tagged, you know, with a gang sign or whatever it is. That is not religious desecration. But if you paint a swastika on the church or on the grounds of that church, like that we saw with the Anchorage Baptist Temple burning, that in fact qualifies. So I want to kind of delineate between stupidity and desecration, for lack of a better I mean, those are not, none of those are legally descriptive terms, but I think the meaning should be very clear and on the record.
Thank you. Brief at ease. Back on the record. I believe Representative Groh, Representative Carpenter had more questions.
Thank you. And I've just spaced where we left off, but I wanted to talk about the word public in two. I have been to a church facility, religious facility, where there's a big fence, chain link fence around it. So it's pretty private. What if it is a private education activity that's happening? It's not public. Would the word public being thrown in there eliminate the desecration that happens because the church was there only for its private membership and not for the public?
Through the chair, Andy Josephson, Representative Carpenter. So I think in the circumstance with a sort of a private event fenced in, a member or attendee of the event defaces, damages, or desecrates, they'd be into I or triple I. And that might be the smarter way to charge this. That's my first reaction. I also don't know, I can't answer how this word public would be used and whether it means open to the public in the way of social accommodation, or rather a public accommodation is open to the public, or if it just means more than one human being collectively. I just couldn't answer that.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have legal online?
My apologies. We are unable to get legal. They do not have a criminal attorney backup at the moment, but we've been trying this afternoon.
Follow up. I agree with Representative Carpenter that this word, the public, is problematic. So my question, if we had legal, is could we simply do an amendment to the amendment to delete the words the public and just have it used to educate about a religion? It makes more sense to me. Thank you.
Any further questions from committee members? Representative Allard.
Thank you. Madam Chair, it seems like we have a lot of discussion going on, and I wanted to move to withdraw the amendment just for the time being until we can get legal. That way we're more informed, because we're going down little rabbit holes here. We're trying to stay above it. And even though we have a room, I think, full of three attorneys and even a former judge, I think that we probably need to delay this just a little bit, if that's all right with you. So I want to move to withdraw the amendment.
Hearing no objection, amendment number one has been withdrawn. This has been a wonderful discussion and proves, you know, there are a lot of details to this, but I encourage us to deliberate on exactly what this language should be. Because we want to make sure that the intent is very clear. It seems that the way that it's worded could be far-reaching. But we will bring this back before the committee again. And we will set House Bill 238 aside, and I'm setting an amendment deadline for this bill to be this Monday, March 4th, 5 p.m. to our office. And want to thank Representative Josephson and his staff for being here today. That concludes our business. The House Judiciary Committee meeting will meet again on Monday, March 4th at 1 p.m. to bring back House Bill 67, Harassment, Sex Offenders, and Offenses, as presented by the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. It is 2:22 p.m.